for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In his State of the Union address, President Obama pushed job creation to the top of his agenda. Democratic leaders in Congress say they're committed to passing health care legislation this year, even if it means doing it piece by piece. And a congressional committee plans to investigate the recall of millions of Toyotas suspected of sudden acceleration. Joining me for the Friday News Roundup, Jim Engel of Fox News Channel, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine, and PoliticsDaily.com. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
David Korn, tell me about this plan to change the venue for the 9/11 terror suspects.
Well, we don't have a plan yet. What seems to have happened that in the last couple of days, New Yorkers, particularly Mayor Michael Bloomberg, who supported originally the administration's plan to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in Lower Manhattan near the site of the former Trade Towers, has come out and said basically it's going to be too expensive. And these estimates that were once in the hundreds of millions or some have ballooned to $1 billion in security costs. And maybe, I don't know, maybe they're figuring in also the loss of business to local businesses that might have been shut down and so on and so forth. So he has said it's going to be too expensive. And now you have other members of the New York delegation in Congress joining the chorus. And the administration saying, well, we are going to have to listen and look at other options. You know, they talk about my old hometown of White Plains, New York, outside of New York City.
And even West Point.
Yeah, but first of all, this is, I mean, it was going to be in Manhattan for primarily symbolic reasons. And what I think is the bigger issue potentially going on here is a reopening of this whole argument over whether he should be tried in a civilian criminal court at all. I think that, you know, a lot of conservatives and Republicans have argued that this should be done in a military tribunal. And so I think that they are going to seize upon this argument to go back to the other argument, which is that, you know, essentially civilian courts are incapable of doing something like
this. Jim Engel, a new discussion opening?
Well, it's an old discussion that's been reopened. I mean, the idea of trying these guys in New York was a symbolic act. It was always one that was going to be difficult politically. Now you have every Democrat in the known universe telling the administration, you can't do this. You cannot come here and try these guys. We don't know how long it's going to take. You don't know how many blocks you're going to have to close. You don't know what the security arrangements are going to be. It could paralyze part of New York City. It's going to cost $250 million a year. If the trial goes on for a couple of years, it could be more expensive. I mean, there were just one complaint after another. When Mayor Bloomberg heard all these complaints from people in New York, he switched. Now you have all the members of Congress who are begging the administration to find another place. And so the plan to do this and the way they had intended to do it is dead. And they've got to find another place. And when they find another place, then there will be arguments about, well, how do we do this?
Do you think it's dead, Karen?
I think it's dead to do it in Manhattan. But, I mean, I think Virginia is such an obvious choice because they've done it there before.
But they're doing it in New York City as well. One of the guys who was involved in the embassy bombings in Africa, which was an al-Qaeda operation, he's being tried, and they have been tried. I mean, far be it for me to second-guess the mayor of New York, but it seems to me like there's a little bit of hysteria here about the cost. We have tried al-Qaeda-related terrorists in New York City. Now, you know, and I don't think al-Qaeda needs any more incentive to mount an operation against Manhattan than it has already,
from
its own perspective. So, I mean, the idea that, you know, that if you bring him up there, all of a sudden everyone in the world is going to want to blow up Manhattan, that kind of already, that urge already exists.
But you have to have the security. I mean, you can't do it with, you can't try the 9/11 hijackers without massive security, the same kind of security you have when the president goes down the street.
But they've done Al-Qaeda terrorists already in Manhattan with what they deemed was sufficient security. So the question is, how overboard do you have to go for this trial? But I also think that, you know, you talk about reopening the old argument. The argument before, Republicans were often using it to make the case that Obama was weak on terrorism. Not that they just disagreed with his policy, criminal trials versus military trials. So I imagine now they will see yet again another opening to argue the case that Obama is weak on terrorism and national security.
David Korn, he is Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine, Karen Tumulty of Time Magazine, Jim Engel of Fox News Channel. 800-433-8850. Let's move on to the aftermath of the President's State of the Union address. The President said he would not walk away from health care reform. Karen, did he really outline a way forward, or are Democrats going to do it piece by piece? Are Republicans going to hold firm?
He did not outline a way forward. And quite frankly, I don't think the Democratic leaders in Congress want him to outline a way forward. I think at this point, the person to watch is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And she has at least the outlines of a tactical plan to do this. And it would have three parts. The first one would be to get some changes to the basic Senate bill. And there are some things that are in the bill that passed the Senate, things like the Cadillac tax on high-end health plans. The House would like to see these health insurance exchanges based in the states and not nationally. They want these sweetheart deals like Ben Nelson's taken out of there. So they would do all these fixes in a bill that could pass on a majority vote in the Senate called reconciliation, part of the budget process. Then, after that would happen, they would pass the basic Senate bill. So they would essentially get both of these things to the president's desk. And then there are things that you cannot do under this reconciliation process. And those things would come in a series of separate bills, things like repealing the antitrust exemption for the insurance companies, possibly some of the ways you would structure these exchanges. It's very convoluted. It's very complicated. But it gets you to the finish line, and it gets you to the finish line with a comprehensive health care package.
Talk about sausage making, Dave.
Well, you know, Karen and I were in a meeting with some other reporters earlier this week with Nancy Pelosi, who was outlining all this. And part of the issue is, which she talked about, is who goes first, the House or the Senate? Because basically the House is basically saying, we will accept the Senate deal, which has things in it we don't like, if the Senate changes those through this separate bill called reconciliation. But they don't want to accept the Senate bill until the Senate goes to reconciliation. Yesterday, Kent Conrad, who is a senator, chairs the Budget Committee, which would be in charge of reconciliation, told one of my reporters, Nick Bauman, Mother Jones, that he can see this using reconciliation to amend the bill, not to pass a separate bill, but to amend the bill. But he says, you know what? Our people here, our parliamentarian experts, say we may not be able to go through reconciliation until there is a bill passed by the House, meaning the House has to pass our bill, then we'll put the changes in. So a lot of this stuff still has to be worked out, but it could be done quickly if they think they negotiate how to do it.
And the important thing to remember here is there is, at the moment, almost no trust between the House and the Senate to follow through on any kind of deal.
What a mess.
Well, they're trying to figure out how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, and it's not that easy. That's why you always have this notion that you can do this reconciliation process. It comes up about once every 10 days. It dies about 5 days into that. It's resurrected 5 days later because there is no other way they can figure out to do this. problem with reconciliation, it can only be done for things that have a budget score. This was this whole process is for budget matters. So that excludes, for instance, abortion. So how would you, you've got Bart Stupak, got the only amendment to the House plan because Nancy Pelosi could not pass it without the anti-abortion Democrats. He had 60-something votes for his amendment. 41 of them voted for the final bill. She won by 5 votes. Now, how many of those people will vote for a plan that does not have their language? We hear that Stupak has 11 or 12 people who will not accept the Senate language on abortion.
That's what he says.
What some of them say.
Yeah.
So if that were the case, then what do you do? That's only one obstacle. Then on the exchanges that Karen mentioned, the House wants national exchanges, the Senate wants state exchanges. It's hard to see how you could do that under reconciliation. There are a lot of these issues that are very difficult to fix under reconciliation, not much less the question of who goes first.
Of course, the president is meeting today with Republicans. Following his State of the Union address, when he said, I want to change the tone, I'm still determined to change the tone in Washington, and he said, I'm going to meet with Republicans, and he said, I bet you can't wait for that. And so what positive something might come out of this?
At the moment, I would be predicting nothing. This is a Republican issues retreat. It's essentially the president is going to address the entire Republican caucus of the House. That is not the sort of setting, I think, that obstacles are overcome in, and it's not the kind of setting that really changes. It changes the public's view, but not the actual dynamic.
Karen Temelty of Time Magazine, Jim Engel of Fox News Channel, David Korn of Mother Jones, and PoliticsDaily.com. And another announcement the president made during his State of the Union address was in regard to the construction of high-speed rail. Here's an email from William. He is in some part of Maryland. He says, the president asked why the United States cannot do what many other nations in Europe and Asia can do, but then announces a high-speed rail link that merely runs from Tampa to Orlando. Is not that an answer to his question, namely that the U.S. is bedeviled by distribution destinations to a degree that far exceeds anything other more densely populated nations face? David.
Well, you know, when talking about rail and having high-speed rail, one issue with America as opposed to European nations and Japan is that we're so damn big, just geographically. And we have corridors that we can focus on, obviously the Northeast Corridor, places in California and Florida, which is getting the lion's share of the first amount of investment. But, you know, we're less a planned society in terms of our transportation infrastructure. We haven't really planned much since the federal highway system, which Obama has referred to in talking about high-speed rail. But to lay down the tracks to and to find, like in congested areas like the Northeast Corridor, to set up a new line of tracks, a new set of tracks, becomes incredibly difficult and expensive.
So he left out this Northeast Corridor. He's talking about California. He's talking about Illinois. He's talking about Tampa to Orlando, all of which would create some jobs, which is also what the president's going to be talking about today, I gather, Jim.
That's right. At the Republican retreat, he is going to give out more details on his jobs plan. The administration is making an interesting shift now, an interesting push to go for small business. Why they didn't do this earlier is a mystery to me, because everybody knows that most jobs in normal times, 70% of jobs are created by small business. I mean, you don't start off by hiring 1,000 people. You hire one or two people, and then you hire a couple more as the business expands. And that is where the money is, if you will, in job creation. So the administration is now shifting toward that, more money to small banks to make loans to small business, incentives for small businesses to create jobs, a $5,000 a job incentive, forgiving some payroll taxes. The problem is small businesses are not going to hire, the small business reps say, until they know that there is demand from the public for their product. They may hire a little earlier. They may hire one or two more people than they would have, but they're not going to hire people just because they got a $5,000 bonus from the government for hiring someone. So this may help at some point, but it may not help until the economy starts to recover. So it could accelerate things once it recovers. It's not going to take them off from a dead standstill.
Karen. Well, I think, too, that they're trying to influence some of the decisions. Like when you get a little bit of extra business for a small business, they're trying to decide between giving the workers they have a few extra hours or actually bringing in a new worker with the attendant costs and benefits, et cetera. And I do think that in those kinds of cases, a little bit of a tax break can actually make a difference. If you're going to be hiring anyway, or at least expanding your work hours anyway, those can be the difference between a decision that actually gives a new job.
Yeah, reduce some of the obstacles.
Jim, Aunt Goley, here's a tweet from CBS. He says, the president needs to forget about bipartisanship, get on with doing something for all of us. The party of no is not about to change. Do you see any opportunity, any willingness on the part of Republicans to move toward the president?
On any number of issues, I think there is some middle ground. The president's biggest problem right now is Democrats. As we were just talking about, the Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate.
It's not just the Democrats.
Well, on health care, it is.
Well,
on
health care,
you could have agreement. You passed a bill in the House by a small margin. You passed a bill in the Senate. They're entirely different. And the issue now is, how do we get Democrats in the House and Democrats in the Senate to agree? You could pick off some Republicans, and that will be the effort going forward, would be to find a way. The administration hasn't decided what it wants to do. Do they want to pare back and do something and draw in some Republicans, or do they want to stick with what they have now? And what they have now is not very popular in the country.
I'm not at all sure that many Republicans are gettable on pretty much of anything. And we saw a vote this week in the Senate on this. It was a bipartisan idea to create a bipartisan commission to deal with the federal deficit. And six of the Republican co-sponsors of that idea voted against it on the Senate floor. I mean, they had been co-sponsors of the bill. And it's hard to, imagine that was anything other than not wanting to give the Democrats cover on an idea that they liked.
The president has problems with the Democrats because the Republicans have set up the territory where he needs more Democratic support than he would otherwise. You have to have a supermajority in the Senate. Why? Because the Republicans want to kill virtually any health care initiative that would be a political success or a win for the president.
So do you think the president is going to get some kind of health care reform? Or is this a no-win?
No, I think the Democrats, I think at this point, they know they need to pass something. The sooner, the better. Get it off the table. They've lost a lot of the political debate due to their own carelessness and neglect, and that goes up to the White House. And they just got to get it over, because going into the next election, it's better to have something accomplished than to have been beaten back by the teabaggers and the Tea Party people and the Republicans.
One of the moments that an awful lot of people have been talking about in regard to the State of the Union address is the moment when the president talked about campaign finance and the actions of the Supreme Court. And Justice Alito, sitting there with cameras on him, shook his head and said, what, Jim Engle?
It appeared, either said, that's not true or not true.
What'd you make of that?
Well, he is apparently correct in that judgment. I mean, what the president said, had he said it a different way, it would be more defensible. But what he said was, this opens the door to foreign corporations contributing money to politicians. That is simply not true.
If
that part of the law was,
a foreign corporation has a stake in an American corporation,
like Citgo,
can that corporation then influence?
The Supreme Court decision did not change the law in one fundamental respect. Corporations cannot contribute to political to a politician's campaign.
Right.
They can contribute to other things, but they can do that now. They can already do that. This decision did not change the fundamentals of what corporations, even those that are subsidiaries of foreign corporations, can do.
David.
But they had to go through PACs. They couldn't use their general treasury funds. What this, you know, what this decision said was that corporations who have the rights of individuals, complete free speech rights, and, it actually, listen, the right always goes on about judicial activism. There's 100 years of precedent that they just threw out the window. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor, she shook her head at this decision. So this was no slam dunk, as opposed when you get rid of something like Dred Scott. And this was something that, you know, also could have been legislated. And I've yet to hear one conservative critic out there, one Republican, come forward and say, oh, the courts legislate. They're legislating from the bench. That's what they did. The president, I think, was right to raise this as a threat. And if, you know, and the other point is, Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, in States of the Union and State of the Union speeches and other addresses, they routinely criticized Roe v. Wade and other Supreme Court decisions. And so for anyone to get on Obama's case for raising this issue, anyone on the Republican side who didn't attack Reagan and Bush for doing that, it's another example of hypocrisy.
Well, I think it is a little bit different for the president in a State of the Union address with the Supreme Court sitting there looking directly at him to have criticized them for a decision that this precise court had just made. I think that was it was a very extraordinary moment and a provocative act on the part of the president. But I think it speaks to, sort of that, you know, yet another kind of cultural barrier of Washington coming down.
All right. And another issue or person was finally approved yesterday, and that was Ben Bernanke. What do you make of that vote, Karen? It was 70-30.
Which does not sound even close to close. It was an overwhelming vote, but it was also the lowest number of votes that any Fed chairman has ever gotten in the history of the Fed, which goes back practically a century, I think. It was sort of an odd coalition that we saw on the Senate floor. There were people opposed to Bernanke from the left and people opposed to him from the right, primarily on the question of whether he was asleep at the switch when the whole financial crisis was developing before 2008. Most people, I think, thought he had handled himself pretty well since then.
But it was while he was sitting on the Fed.
Right, although he had divorced himself from some of those decisions after he was nominated. Look, the key thing here about the Bernanke thing, what people have lots of complaints and questions about the whole run-up and the financial collapse and everything that was done. But the main thing here was that you had the election in Massachusetts where you saw this outpouring of disgust and anger from voters, including a lot of independents. And suddenly members of Congress went, wow, the public is mad. They're really irritated. And they wanted to get in on this anger. And what better? The first target up was Ben Bernanke. And actually, Dick Durbin, who's in the Democratic leadership in the Senate, was very funny about this the other day. He said, when asked what he was doing to try to sell the Bernanke nomination, he said, I tell my colleagues that voting against Bernanke is not the only way to show that you care. And that was, in fact, what was happening here. So you have people saying, I'm mad, too. You know, I'm going to get this guy. And then what did they do? Bernanke, then they started in on Geithner.
Well, Geithner's lucky that he doesn't have to come up for a vote again. There is a bigger principle here, and something that even transcends politics and reacting to the Scott Brown victory in Massachusetts, and that is the notion of accountability. You know, who have we seen lose their job, be punished, lose one of their four summer houses, you know, because they screwed up the economy? You know, for 20, 30, 40 years, we developed a financial system where the rest of us, our pension, our 401ks and our job security was tied into the casino-like activities of the financial sector, which kept saying that it's like what's good for GM, like what's good for us, is good for America. Turns out that wasn't really the case. And even though they've come back and the Dow's back up, we have 10% unemployment that's likely to stretch through the rest of the year. We have economic growth happening, but no job growth. Very little. And so I think people are right to say, well, who gave us this in the first place? Shouldn't they at least lose their jobs, if not their savings accounts?
David Korn of Mother Jones Magazine, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And in the meantime, with the, as you say, the stock market going up, Ford showing really wonderful sales, what's happening to Toyota?
Whoa.
Wow.
That's helping American car companies right now.
Yeah,
I mean, they've had
sure.
this accelerator issue. But I know several friends. I mean, it's like their most popular models. They've had to freeze sales, and they have to call them back in. They say that this has only happened, you know, a very small number of times.
19 times.
So people don't have to panic. But
yeah.
It is the type of problem that you don't want to get caught in yourself.
So GM is offering great deals these days.
Yeah, GM is saying, fine, yeah, trade them in, come
exactly.
to GM. I mean, look, the problem was that Toyota tried to expand too fast. And they saw these problems. They've known about them for several years. And they just, we'll fix that. And, you know. They neglected to take action sooner because they didn't want to. You're talking about hundreds of thousands and then millions of cars that you have to recall. And, you know, when you move too fast on these things, you cause problems. And I would, in response to what David was saying earlier about the financial crisis, we also did that with housing. If you remember, we moved too fast.
Yeah.
What we did was we created easy credit for people who didn't have any business buying a house. And knowing, you know at some point that push is going to come to shove, that the bottom's going to fall out. Whenever you rush into anything, you know that there is a risk that you have not foreseen all the difficulties.
I just want to make sure that whatever is wrong with his automobile gets fixed before anybody else loses their lives.
Take it in.
I mean, very serious stuff. Tell me about this Mary Landrieu stuff, David.
Well, this is James O'Keefe, who came to national prominence a few months back when he did these videos targeting Acorn, where he posed as a pimp and had a friend come in as a sex worker to get, you know, tax advice and other advice from Acorn offices. And there's still some dispute whether, you know, the videos were completely accurate depictions. There were some Acorn offices that claimed they threw the people out. There were some Acorn people who obviously talked to them in ways they shouldn't have. But whether that had anything to do with the core work of Acorn is a separate political fight. But nevertheless, he became a conservative star on Fox News. He was, you know, hailed over and over again, blogospheres. There was even, I forget who now, but a Republican member of Congress put in a resolution to commend him. And that resolution, by the way, I believe is still pending. Anyway, a couple of days ago, he was arrested in New Orleans with three associates, and the affidavit or the FBI indictment says that they were arrested for tampering with the phone system of Senator Mary Landrieu in her New Orleans, you know, district office. A lot of us thought that meant bugging, wiretapping. We still don't know the details, but NBC was reporting yesterday that they might have been trying to shut down her phones in order to film her, you know, her staff in some ways to show that they don't care about constituent calls.
Makes
it's
no
all very
sense.
Convoluted.
There is a the context of this is that Mary Landrieu, and I think she's not the only one, has come under some criticism at home because people who are upset about her vote on the health care bill have been trying to call her office and have been complaining about getting busy signals. And so, first of all, I think that these three stooges sound like they were probably not capable of doing whatever it took to the phone system. But the fact that O'Keefe was sitting there with his cell phone, apparently intending to use it to videotape this, I suspect what they were trying to do was to get videos of Landrieu's staffers ignoring the phones or being rude to callers or being dismissive of callers. And Mary Landrieu's staff immediately suspected these people. I think she, you know, ought to be very proud of her staff.
Karen Dummelty of Time Magazine. When we come back, we'll open the phones and hear your thoughts on this Friday News Roundup. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. World leaders meet in London to discuss the future of Afghanistan. Chemical Ali is executed in Iraq. And the latest on earthquake-ravaged Haiti. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. It's time to go to the phones. First to Fairport, New York. Good morning, Joyce. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm very happy to be able to express my anger. I am one of the angry people out here, and I'm primarily angry at two things. One, I'm very angry at a Republican Party that for 8 years dominated, did everything in secrecy, put everything under the banner that if you're not for us, you're against us, and if you dared to question anything about going to war or whether there really were weapons of mass destruction and everything else, you're unpatriotic, un-American. They could ruin your reputation. They, in fact, it turns out, suppressed even fair reporting of a lot of this, who are now acting in lockstep negativity that is petulant, spoiled, absolutely ridiculous. They are all servants who have sworn to uphold the Constitution, to work for the good of the country, to do what needs to be done. They are saying no consistently, and they are then screaming that they are being left out of everything and nobody's listening to them. The second thing that I'm angry about is, and I'm fortunately can say your panel did address it today and I'm starting to hear more about it, but I do not see the press pointing this out often enough. As they're doing all of their negativity, it is not being pointed out how they were doing the very thing that they claimed was un-American and unconstitutional and unpatriotic. By their own definition, these people are acting in an unpatriotic, an un-American way. Ooh. So I want to thank your panel today, the ones who did address this, but I hear a great deal of this kind of anger out in the public, which
right.
I do not see being addressed.
All right. Okay. Thanks for your call. Karen.
Well, that sounds a lot like the anger that got Barack Obama elected in 2008. But I do think that has been, at least in my own reporting, and I was up in Massachusetts for the Senate race, I think there is – it's a different kind of anger that got, for instance, Scott Brown elected. And a lot of it is just a frustration with the process, the idea that Washington has – completely ceased to produce, you know, that there's a lot coming out of Washington, but people look at it and they say, yeah, but, you know,
that's
what's in there for
enough.
Me? Yes.
That's not enough.
And it's not for me.
And it's not moving quickly enough. Whatever is coming out isn't there for me, and it's not quick enough.
Well, they saw it also that tens or hundreds of billions of dollars move very fast for the banks and financial firms.
Of course.
And, you know, the economy, which is very hard to move in terms of job creation in a recovery situation, could take years for the average worker to see anything of benefit.
Here's an email from Lloyd, who's in Winterville, North Carolina. He says, it's going to be hard for the parties to work together. Max Baucus thought he was negotiating with Chuck Grassley, but Grassley voted against the resulting agreement. He wasn't a bipartisan legislator. He was a double agent.
Well, I don't know that, but I do think that in retrospect, and the people at the White House probably believe this now, too, that letting those kinds of negotiations that were leading nowhere go on as long as they did, I think did do a lot of collateral damage to the health care bill in particular.
All right. To Winchester, Virginia. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. Mara Liasson has said twice, and the NPR's Mara Liasson has said twice, it is absolutely inconceivable that if the Republicans had had these kinds of majorities in both houses, they could not have gotten their program passed. Second, in the mid-60s, the Congress got civil rights legislation passed by changing rules in as necessary so that legislation could go forward.
So what's your conclusion, Nick?
My conclusion is, if the Congress wishes to be considered a co-equal branch of government, it's got to get its own houses in order and be able to accomplish something, not just sit there and yammer.
Jim Engel.
Well, I mean, part of the problem is that is what Congress does best, is sit there and yammer. And people, various representatives, think they are representing, they have their own views, which they're representing, and they think they're representing their constituents, and not everyone has the same view. If you look at the health care process, for instance, you have lots of people coming to this issue with very different views. In the House, they wanted a public option, a government-run health care plan. In the Senate, you absolutely no way could you pass that, even with the Democrats. So you have very different issues. And I must say, and we were talking earlier about this, the president has stayed on the sidelines on this to some extent. They have worked behind the scenes. They have talked to congressional leaders in an effort to try to find some middle ground. But the president has not laid down the law. It is going to be impossible for members of Congress to ever come to agreement on big issues like this when they have deep differences unless someone from outside cracks the whip.
Or unless you finally get around to changing the rules of the Senate.
Well, Nick, though, suggests that somehow the Republicans would have operated with a lot more discipline than the Democrats have. By definition, when you have a larger majority in Congress, it's because Democrats are being elected from districts that normally in the past have elected Republicans, or Republicans are coming from places with a lot of Democrats in them. And when you get these more moderate members, it's harder to sort of get them to march in lockstep. Second, Bill Frist, don't forget, tried to change the rules on judicial nominations. They called it the nuclear option, and he failed. So I don't think – I think it's sort of a myth that the Republicans were that much more disciplined when they were in the majority.
All right. This email goes back to the trials in New York. Michael says, since when did we become a nation of cowards? Sheikh Mohammed is easily the worst criminal in the history of the state of New York and the U.S. How can it be that Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, who lost more than 3,000 citizens and sustained billions of dollars of damage, does not want the greatest city in the world to deliver justice to this murderer? These terrorists can smell the fear of our elected leaders, chiefly Republicans, says he, and I'll bet you they are loving it. Every press conference that talks about how difficult and dangerous it will be to put these criminals on trial elevates them to heroic heights in the eyes of their supporters. David.
Well said. I mean, you know, we used to have this cliche, well, then the terrorists have won. And you see that time and time again. You see that in this whole issue of whether we can bring some of the Guantanamo detainees to a U.S. maximum facility in Florence, Colorado, or some other place.
You ought to see David's body language as he says.
And, you know, people say
this.
That we can't, you know, we have people locked up, but, you know, who have never escaped from these places, but we act in fear of bringing people ashore for
right.
that reason.
I mean, here's another right. comment on that. Brad in Burlington, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to address the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed thing. It has nothing to do with being afraid. It has to do with a philosophy of conservatives such as myself look at these guys as enemy combatants and prisoners of war. You guys, like David Corn, look at them as criminals, and you want to put them in a and our objection is he's going to get in court, and he's going to spout all of this stuff. It's going to be open, so he's going to be, you know, his followers are going to be able to listen to what he says. And just one other thing, Diane, when people like David Corn use the word teabagger, that's a pejorative, and I wish you'd call people on it.
I will. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
It's Jim, not David.
I'm sorry.
I just want to make sure.
I'd like to respond.
I'll let you in a minute.
But, this is a fundamental disagreement and one that has caused the administration some difficulties here. Look, they decided with Abdulmutallab to Mirandize him, to give him his rights. You have the right to a lawyer, right to remain silent, so on and so forth, in less than an hour after he had been arrested. Without consulting anyone in the intelligence community, anyone in the counterterrorism community, or the head of the FBI. So they went ahead and did this on the orders of the Justice Department. Now you have everyone in the intelligence and counterterrorism community comes out and says, were you consulted? No, we weren't consulted. What they would have done is that they would have talked to him for days and try to learn everything he possibly knew about the way that al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula was working, what their goals were, who their other people. There are 1,000 things you ask people. They sometimes interrogate these people for months And instead, you got a guy who was in obvious pain from having injured himself in this process, and ask him questions for less than 50 minutes. And then
who said 50 minutes? I had heard 36 hours. That he was asked questions for 36 hours, and that the Department of Justice or whoever was talking with him got an awful lot of information out of him in the process.
They interrogated him for 50 minutes before they gave him his Miranda rights. He was not charged for 36 hours, but he was only interrogated for 50 minutes.
David?
On the use of teabaggers, I'll apologize for that, but I'm still waiting for the Republicans to apologize for having a Tea Party rally that Michelle Bachmann organized, where there were people there shouting and with signs that had racist and anti-Semitic messages.
All right, unofficial. Refer to them as members of the Tea Party.
I just said I would do that, but okay. I think it's more courtesy than they've shown the president and other people as well. But on the issue of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed using a trial as a platform, we have tried in civilian court Musawi, the African embassy bombers, the blind sheik, Richard Reed. This has happened over and over and over again, and at the time I haven't heard anybody. This was under a Republican president. I haven't heard anybody make that claim that we shouldn't give them trials because they might say something at the trial. I mean, Musawi said a lot of pretty dumb things at the trial. So, and my big question is, so what? Why do we give a damn about what they want to do, about what they think? It should be what we think is right in terms of justice here. I don't care what KSM is going to say or do.
All right, let's go to Stowe, Ohio. Good morning, Dolores. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm surprised, Diane, that neither today nor yesterday, in connection with the president's speech, have you talked about the fact that he said he's going to freeze domestic spending for 3 years, and Nancy Pelosi says she won't go along with that. Watching her face when he said that really told a story. He said that he would veto it if Congress didn't go along with it. That's something that's really disturbed me. I would like comments on that. Thank you.
I'm so glad you brought it up, and we'll talk about it right now, Karen.
It's these sorts of I would call freezing domestic spending a gesture. It really doesn't save all that much money, and in fact, it was something that Barack Obama, I believe, something like $3 billion was the. 30 billion. Well, anyway, it doesn't save a lot of money. And it was the kind of thing that Barack Obama as a presidential candidate mocked when John McCain suggested
the
same thing.
And the reason it doesn't save all that money is because all these big ticket items
it's only discretionary
exactly.
spending.
Non-defense exactly. discretionary.
Non-defense
which
discretionary
Pelosi
spending.
Was talking about.
And 60% of the budget is mandatory programs.
Right.
So it's a very small sliver of things. He excluded defense. Pelosi and some other members of the Democratic leadership say you have to include defense. And they have openly disputed the president on the wisdom of doing this and are opposing this effort and are being quite open about it, in fact.
All right. And a call from Miami, Florida. Good morning, Oren.
Good morning. I wanted to take issue with the Supreme Court's characterization of a corporation as a person, which I think is the mugging of common sense and fairness. Corporations don't have the same risk horizon as persons do. Persons have an average life of, say, 88 years and have an average work life of, say, 50 years. So I think if we're really going to say that corporations should be treated as persons, let them inject a statute which says that corporations expire after 88 years. And then we have an equilibrated risk horizon. I think as a result of this Supreme Court decision, we could now say, without fear of contradiction, that the U.S. Congress is the largest and most expensive house of prostitution in the United States.
Oren, I appreciate your call, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. I don't want to quite make this a segue, but I would like to ask you about why John Edwards' situation is quite so important to our country. I think about the fact that this man could have become President, Karen.
Well, and yeah, in fact, and quite recently, and he was on the national ticket quite recently. But the fact is, the reason it gets so much attention is it's just a salacious
and pretty
story.
Big lie for a politician.
Well, see, that's the amazing thing to me is that here's a guy who's confronted with this. He wants to run for president, and then if he's not going to be able to be president, he wants a major cabinet position. He wants to speak at the Democratic convention. He knows that he's lying, and he is flat out lying about this when he is confronted about
and
it. And
his
yet he
wife
is,
knows he's lying.
Yes,
too.
And well, yet he is willing to put his party at risk. Had he been more successful in the running, willing to put his nation at risk by running for president, by trying to take a prominent role in the party at a time when he knew he was lying. And these things never remain secret. There is no way this remains secret.
I have to say, I'm outraged at the outrage. Listen, I don't see the same amount of outrage about David Vitter, John Ensign, and of course Bill Clinton did this while he was president. Even it wasn't when he was trying to become president. And so, you know, I'm not saying this to defend John Edwards.
Bill Clinton didn't do exactly this.
Well, no, but you can argue whether it's worse or not, but he did something he should not have done.
But there are degrees, David.
Well, you know, you can talk to your loved ones about degrees, but I don't know.
I think there is an arrogance among politicians that we can never forget, and when they lie to us, it's pretty darn bad. And I personally am angry. So there, that's all I want to say. Thank you.
Glad you
so
could get that
much.
Off. Just...
Jim Engel, Karen Tumulty, David Korn, thanks a lot. Thanks for listening, everybody. Have a great weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.